tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. As many of you know that this is retreat period, but it's always very difficult to find the perfect situation. There's always some things which interrupt us, always some little chore, job, some friendly assistance to be done. And just like outside of the retreat, there's work, but there's plenty of opportunity to meditate. And part of our skill in meditating is to make use of all opportunities, whatever we have. So it's not just a case of trying to get the perfect situation where one can just sit and meditate all day without any sort of jobs to be done. I was joking to someone earlier in the interviews. Who knows one day that our monasteries here at Bodhinyana at Dhammasara may one day be rich enough that the sisters will never have to do any more work, nor will the monks. That we will have butlers for every monk, so anything you want will be offered to you straight away. We'll have a maintenance officer to fix your gas and electricity. You won't need to wash up, we'll have professional cooks with a menu which you can pre-order the day before. If it's your own retreat, everything will be brought to your hut, hot and delivered. And anything you ever want will be there for you. You don't have to do any manager work. We'll have accountants and managers, everyone to do all of this. And even me, I won't have even to give a talk. I'll delegate that to a robot to give all the talks. So that we can just have a wonderful time, all be in retreat for 24 hours. 365 days a year, and so we'll all get enlightened. Wouldn't that be wonderful? You know, sometimes when you meditate, you can fantasize like that, but back to reality. Sort of, even if you had that perfect situation, you know, where you had a hut and a meditation chair, sometimes as a young monk, you try to design the most perfect meditation chair, my perfect meditation chair. It would have all these controls on it so that, you know, if my knees were aching, just move them up a bit. And I see we have these chairs which have massage as well, so if you've got a bit sore in your back, you can just massage it. You know, heat controlled. And also that, you know, you just press a button to make you a cup of tea if you need to have a cup of tea, so you wouldn't need to get up. And obviously just the catheter, so you wouldn't need to go to the toilet. It wouldn't need to be disturbed at all. Now you can see just how crazy those ideas become. And even if you did have that perfect situation, it wouldn't work. Because one thing which I notice, it's just the attitude which one has to meditation, the attitude which one has to life, the attitude which one has to going to the toilet, shaving your hair, eating your food. That is the most important part of this meditation. As I kept on saying to many people, it's not the object of your mind which is important, whether it's a nimitta or whether it's dullness or whether it's just, you know, having to do some work, if that's the object of your mind. What's really, really, really important is the attitude you have to what you're doing. And so if you are having to do a little job for somebody, that's beautiful, that's caring for them. And if you use that in a beautiful way, you're caring for somebody, you're helping them out. Bringing their food to them during their retreat, helping fix something up for them because you can't do it yourself. You're driving one of the monks to the dentist, or whatever it is you're doing. And never ever have negativity to the little chores you have to do. Because you'll find if you have negativity to those chores you have to do during the day, then when you go and sit down in meditation, you have negativity to your tiredness, negativity to the ache in your body. You're developing this mind, which is a fault-finding mind, now, which develops that negativity. And you'll find there's no way you'll be able to get still, peaceful meditations. There's no way you'll be able to get the insight, which is based on those peaceful states. on the alternative side, that, you know, if you're asked to do something, if you're washing up, you put joy and happiness into doing it, have this beautiful attitude, this is a service to the Sangha. You're making merit. This is a real Buddhist Sangha, and you're born in an age when you can serve. You can actually do something. Incredible, powerful opportunity to make really powerful karma. Oh, this is brilliant. This is wonderful. I told someone earlier that, you know, that was my attitude. I learned that very quickly in the trainings in Thailand. And it wasn't a question of it's your turn to do the sweeping or it's your turn to do the washing up. I did it yesterday, it's your turn now. Now it's, you know, don't bother me, I've done my bit. That wasn't the way which I learned how to be a Buddhist. It was an opportunity to serve. I remember on one occasion, it was during the rainy season retreat in Wat Nanachat. You know, it was a very heavy rainstorm, and so usually we'd have to get all the water up from the well. But now all the water was pouring out from the gutters. So I got out maybe 45 minutes before the chores began, got the buckets out, filled them up from the gutters, and just filled all of the water tanks which needed to be filled. And I just managed to finish it a couple of minutes before the bell went for the 3 o'clock chores. And all the monks came to do the chores. I smiled and said, guys, you don't have to do anything. It's all been done. I've done the whole lot just myself. And I was so happy about doing that. It wasn't a question of getting out of doing work. It was just seeing how much more I could do, how much I could serve and give. And of course you all know that as a result of that I got incredibly beautiful meditations. It was the attitude I had, fun, serving, doing good karma. And that attitude is what we should develop no matter what we have to do in this monastery. Even if you're sick, the attitude of sickness, it's making peace, being kind, being gentle, learning from it, not fighting, understanding it. And that's actually how we deal with these things. So there's nothing at all which we need to reject. And everything is something which we can just be still and just watch. It's one of our visitors gave me a very interesting piece of information for, you know, for the last 2 or 3 years. Actually, for a long time earlier, I was always upset about the translation of Samadhi's concentration. And so, first of all, I changed it to sustained awareness, you know, for Samadhi. And about the last couple of years, 3 years, I don't know, somewhere around that, I've used the rendering of stillness for Samadhi. And she was telling me that if you look in the Chinese arguments, you know, these were written maybe 1500 years, 2000 years maybe, somewhere around that time, 1800 years, the first ones written, you know, translating from the Sanskrit originals into Chinese characters. The symbols which they use for Samadhi are the combination of Shu and Guan, which I've almost certainly pronounced incorrectly. But nevertheless, what they mean is, first one is like stillness, still and stop, the combination of still and stop. And Guan is the same word as Kuan Yin, just being mindful, being aware, looking on. And I really sort of, I thought it was a beautiful way of rendering Samadhi. As someone who experiences Samadhi, knows what it is, you know, as an experience, that's a beautiful rendering, much better than anything I've seen so far. And that's what this thing actually is, the stillness, the stopping and just looking on. And of course there's no reason why one cannot do that when one is sick. You can just still stop and just look on. Concentration requires effort. And you know that sometimes you don't have that strength, that effort. You're tired, you're weak. Sometimes, you know, it's because you've been working hard. You can't do that. There's so many other sort of factors which, you know, come up to where you have this energy and strength actually to concentrate the force. And it's very fortunate to know that that doesn't need to be done at all. So even if you are weak, you can still get Samadhi. You don't need the energy of concentration. So instead, we just stop and become still and just look on. And that becomes our Samadhi. It's a very, very beautiful word. And I've often talked about stillness and stopping, but just adding that, just the awareness, the mindfulness which goes along with it, gives that meaning to it, which makes it so much more powerful. It's just not stopping and just becoming dull, is stopping and becoming alert. And of course, you know my teachings of when you do really become still, and if you really do it properly, then the mindfulness actually increases. The energy goes into the knower and it stops going into the doer. So the knower, the mindfulness gets powerful and bright and happy, and wow, you really sort of get buzzing along, because that's what stopping and stillness actually do. And it's great, you can do that with whatever you're doing. So even if you are going to the toilet, if you're having to do some work, just focus on that one thing. And don't complicate it with too many other things. You know, we have to do our little jobs and works, whether it's brushing our teeth or going to the toilet, having a shower. But don't add more onto that than you really have to. If you just do the minimum, I really mean that, do the minimum, just take the shower and just be aware. Just be as still as you possibly can and just watch on. You'll find that you actually preserve so much energy. And you know you're preserving energy because you know that you're brighter, the mind is clearer, you've got more happiness, you sleep less, you feel that something's actually happening. And those are the signs that you're not wasting energy. As human beings, we waste so much energy. It's really ridiculous just thinking and planning and doing things and worrying about things and complaining when we can't really change anything. I remember somebody said, if you can do something about something, then worry about it. But if you can't do anything, what's the purpose of worrying? Just let it go. You're just wasting precious mental energy. That's why that many people have sloth and torpor. It's why many people are dull. It's why many people are negative. Simply because we just waste our energy, and so we feel dull. And when you feel dull, the whole world looks grey. If you preserve your mental energy by stopping, being still, by not complaining, by just whatever work you have to do, just doing it silently, as still as possible, just looking on, doing your job, doing that one thing, you will find that you have energy. It's focusing on the task at hand. And of course, that was really weird for me. I was a builder when I first came. Not when I first came here, I learned how to build. There's one thing which I'd never noticed myself, but the monk who was with me, Ajahn Jaco, he noticed this. And, he looked at me when I was working, laying bricks or cutting wood, and he said, "You really are focused when you work." Of course, it's very hard for you to see yourself. You're just too close to your nose to be able to notice it. But when somebody else has been watching you for many years and they make those comments, I really take them on board. That's someone I trust, and they were seeing something in me. Sometimes they see my faults, sometimes they see my strengths, and that was a strength which they saw, which I thought, my goodness, maybe that's true. And I was focused on what I was doing. When I did something, I gave it everything I got. And that was maybe what I learned from Ajahn Chah: whatever you're doing, give it 100%, whether you're sweeping the paths, 100%, whether you're eating, 100%, whatever you're doing. I'm now giving a talk, that's all I'm doing, I'm not thinking of anything else, 100%. When you're fully focused, then this is what happens. You do get this ability to gain samadhi. So, when you're driving the car, it's great if at all possible. And if you're the anagarika or the layman who's driving, it's quite okay to tell the monk sitting next to you, even if it's me, to shut up. So you can just focus on driving and maintain some of your energy, so it can be a quiet ride. If you are washing up in the kitchen, you can just keep quiet and just do the washing up. You find you actually get much more energy. And same as when the monks are washing their bowls afterwards. You know what it's like if you talk to each other. You can get some fascinating conversations and great jokes and have a wonderful time. But that just sucks up so much energy. And if you really know what you're doing, the wise monks, they just wash their bowl alone. They're just aloof. And if someone asks them a question, where's the sponge or whatever, you answer them. But you don't have a conversation about the nature of sponges. So it's nice and simple. So doing things like that, you're focusing on the task. And that means when you focus just on the task, it means that just when you say meditate, you're just focusing on meditating. You're not doing all these other things. Because sometimes when you guys meditate, you girls as well, the bhikkhunis are here, when you meditate, sometimes you're also planning about, you know, what's the next stage of the stupa project. Sometimes, you know, you're thinking about what you're going to do, you know, when you leave this monastery at the end of the rains retreat, even though it's 6 weeks till the end of this retreat, and it's such a long time in the future. Who knows what's going to happen in 6 weeks' time? The end of the world might come. So what's the point? You may never leave this place alive. So you have a lot of that sort of stuff. Is you're not focused. So what focus means is just doing this one thing at a time. Just the task at hand. So that when you are eating, you're not thinking about the breath. You're just eating. Which is one of the reasons why when people tell me that sometimes when they're doing walking meditation, they try and watch their breath. To me, the way I meditate, and especially the way I do walking meditation, is something fundamentally wrong with that idea. If you're watching your breath, yeah, there may be some advantages to that, but the disadvantages, I would say, would outweigh those advantages. Disadvantages, you know, you're doing two things. You're not focusing on the main task, which is walking. And to be able to mindfully focus just on the walking, just doing that one thing, that singleness of mind is a great training for you. Just the same as eating, you're just eating, focusing on one thing. You're walking, you're focusing on the feet moving. Because what happens when you start focusing on the feet moving, you know, you actually really get settled into the movement of the feet. Again, you know, just as you do the sitting meditation, present moment awareness first of all, you know, then silence, and you're focusing on these feet moving. Then after a while, you know, you're just moving there. Sometimes you ask yourself, who actually moved that foot? Did I tell my foot to move? Did I actually give the instructions to raise the foot? And prior to the walking meditation, you get so mindful, so focused on this process of walking, you actually soon discover it's a natural process. And you're not doing the walking at all. And hopefully when you do the walking meditation, you can get to that state, which, you know, I love that state. You're walking along, and you're just sitting there, you're not doing the walking. You're not turning around. And you actually feel like that it's somebody else's body, somebody else giving all these instructions, but you've got your feet up, just at the controls, just an automatic pilot, cruise control on your car, not even holding the steering wheel, everything automatic. So, you know, you can just watch all this process and you're not doing a thing. You let go of the doer on the body. And you find your body walks just perfectly when you're not there giving it controls. And of course, it's weird when that first happens. It's strange that there you are walking and you're giving not the slightest command. You're aware enough to see, no, you're not doing anything. The body's walking all by itself. Just the same way that you breathe all by yourself. I never told my body, you know, now to breathe in, now to breathe out. It does it quite well without me. And in fact, if I do get involved, it usually gets very uncomfortable. So I let my lungs do the breathing. They're much smarter than I am. And my heart, I let my heart do the pumping. So why can I let my feet do the walking? And of course, this is what happens in walking meditation. That occurs. So the feet are just doing the walking. And you've got another little piece of the jigsaw puzzle of non-self. You always thought that you decided to do the walking, but you don't need to. It can do it all by itself. And something which you always thought you had control over, something which you always thought was necessary to control, to make happen, now you see, happens all by itself. And you're alert just watching all of this. So if you can just walk without having any control, sometimes all this thinking business and everything else, maybe you could do the same there and just leave it alone. So just focusing on just one thing is very beautiful. Because when you focus on one thing, you haven't got so much business to do. And you may say that as well as the word stillness and stopping, as well as just looking on, there's also the implication of the mind focusing on things. And that ability to focus in the meditation just to the one thing is so important. It's that aspect of meditation which I wanted to focus on. I'm focusing on the focus. Because that's what we do with, you know, the present moment awareness. We're actually focusing on just this thing which is happening now. But how do we actually do that? The trouble with many people when we talk about meditation being concentration, when we have that idea, the focus is only achieved through effort. And of course that focus which is achieved through effort is so unstable and unpleasant. It doesn't lead to anything really beautiful or profound. It's the sort of focus which people, you know, use, you know, in schools and universities, and they just tire themselves out. Or they use in work and they get stressed out. That's a sort of hard focus which is coming from the wrong place. But of course there's another way of focusing, and that other way of focusing is just to stop. And it's a natural focus happens. What actually happens is the thing which you stop on, you remain still on, that remains and everything else vanishes. It's why that, you know, samadhi, stillness, focusing, disappearing, I mention those qualities again and again and again. It's why from samadhi we get viraga. You know, samadhi is a stillness, viraga is things fading away and eventually ceasing, vanishing, gone. This whole little process which is essential to the teachings of the Buddha, which is essential to the path of enlightenment, is actually the path of meditation. It's all about what happens when we do focus. You know, I mentioned to many people the simile of the TV set. And I mention these similes because you have to give similes which people in our modern world can recognize. And so they actually see that something's happening here. And it's a beautiful simile for how meditation works. You watch a TV set. I remember watching TV sets, you know, when I was a young kid. And outside of the range retreat, sometimes I go to Ron and Terry Story's house on a Saturday evening, spend some time with them, and they let me watch the news on their TV set. But, and I forget what they've got. I think they've got a ship, a boat, you know, because Ron Story used to like, you know, making these boats, you know, these small replicas, you know, painstaking work. But, you know, he used to like doing that. So I think there was a boat in a bottle on top of the TV. You know, when they turn the TV on, I can see that boat. But after a few minutes of the news, you can only just see, you know, the Prime Minister giving a speech or something. And I noticed, and this was a long time ago, and I noticed every time you watch the TV, if you do watch the TV, that at first you can see what's above the screen, what's to the left, the right and underneath. But after a few moments, you focus in, and you can't even see the edges of the screen. A focusing has happened. What's in the centre remains. What's on the edges have disappeared. You know, when that happens, you don't know the time that the edge of the screen disappeared. It's not suddenly recognised by the mind that now's the point, the edge has vanished. All you know is that before you could see that boat on top of the TV, now you can't, you can only see what's inside the screen. And that particular phenomena is why the TVs work. If you could also always see the edge of the screen, you wouldn't think it was real. You'd remember this is just something happening on a box. But when the edges vanish and you're inside, it does give the same experience as reality. Reality doesn't have edges to it. Same as when you focus inside a TV screen. Now this is exactly what happens when you say just watching your feet doing walking meditation. At first you maybe can hear the sound of the birds, you can maybe see the sides of the path. There's all these other things impinge upon you, but as you focus, all of that vanishes. And all you can feel is the movement of your feet. You don't know when sort of the plant to the side of your path or the rocks or to the end of the path, you don't know when they disappeared, but they're not there anymore. You're focusing. Things vanish when you focus. There's an old story which I used to tell years ago, but this story came up in my meditation this afternoon. I haven't told it for years, and it's a funny story, so it's a nice one to bring up this evening. It's a story, and I think it comes from the Hindu tradition of meditation. It's a story of these three students of the teacher, and the teacher was teaching them meditation. and you know, teaching them how to focus, how to be still, how to gain samadhi, the beautiful stillness of the mind. And after a year or two of training, he decided to give them a test. And his test consisted of giving a bow and arrow to each student in turn. And they had to hit the target, which was a long way away. And the target was a stuffed bird, like a doll. And the teacher would put the bird on a branch of a tree a long way away. And he gave the bow and arrow to the first student and said, "Student, I want to use your powers of meditation, of focus, to shoot that bird." And the student said, "It's too far away. No one can hit the bird that far away." He said, "You can if you focus, if you use the power of meditation. But, student, I don't want you just to hit the bird anywhere. I want you to hit that stuffed bird through the right eyeball." He said, "Impossible." He said, "Focus." So the student focused. And after half an hour, the student gave the sign he was ready to shoot. And the teacher asked, "Can you see the bird on the tree?" And the student said, "Yes." And the student pushed him away, "Stupid student," and took the bow and arrow away and gave it to the second student with the same instructions. "Focus on the right eyeball of that stuffed bird. And when you're one with the target, when you're focused, give me a sign." And this student took 1 whole hour of focusing. And he put his hand up, he was ready to shoot. And the teacher said, "Can you see the bird on the tree?" And the student said, "What tree?" And the master said, "Can you see the bird?" "Yes, master." "Stupid student." And he pulled the bow and arrow away. You're very lucky you haven't got a teacher like that. I'd be pushing you away all the time. And then he gave the bow and arrow to the third student with the same instruction. "Make yourself one with the target. I want you to shoot that arrow through the right eyeball of that bird." And the student took 2 whole hours. And after 2 hours of focusing, the master said, "Can you see the bird on the tree?" And the student said, "What tree?" And the master said, "Can you see the bird?" "What bird?" said the student. And the master said, "What can you see?" "Just an eyeball, that's all." "Ah, well done. Shoot." And of course, the arrow went into the only thing in that student's focus, right through that eyeball. Now that is focusing. That is meditation. That is stillness. Everything else disappears until you can just see one eyeball of that bird. Now you can understand what we do with meditation, what this stillness actually is, what focus actually is. You know, you start with just this present moment. And of course, when you first start, you've got the past and the future, you've got the end of this retreat, you've got what you're going to do after this retreat, you're going to going over to the ordination in Spirit Rock and going over to Norway and what you're going to do next year and whether you're going to come back again next year for this rain, next 2012 rains retreat and all this sort of stuff and where you came from and who you've met in your life and where you were born and who's your mother and who's your father, all that sort of stuff. But when you focus, what mother or father? What end of rains retreat? So when the master says, "Can you see tomorrow?" "No, master." "Can you see 5 minutes ago? Can you see the chanting we did earlier?" "What chanting?" "Ah, good," says the master. "And I'll let you continue meditating." And say, "What can you see?" "Just this moment." "That's what I see." "Well done." And that's what we call that. And that's actually just what happens. In meditation, obviously, we're not sort of asking those questions, but after a while, everything vanishes, that's all you're left with. That's what we mean by focusing. Being a Kodi, just one point, not spread out and stretched over a long expanse of mental phenomena, just one thing. And of course, when that happens, the power of that one-pointedness, even with just present moment awareness, is there to be seen. It's very powerful, very good. So this is actually what one does, what one experiences. It's fun, it's powerful, it's beautiful, it's deep. And of course, every experience you have gives you the insight into the nature of these experiences, what one-pointedness is, even in present moment, and how it's achieved. The most important thing is how it's achieved. Because, you know, whenever you get into any state of focus in meditation, it's great to know what happened, because that's the way you understand how to repeat it. And of course, you all will know that what happened, that thing you did, you may not be able to give it a name, that must be a letting go. A focus where you weren't holding on to the present moment with force, but you were letting go of the past and letting go of the future. Taking away its importance, removing its value, because it's the nature of the mind only to incline to things which it thinks is valuable, important. It's as if our brain has been evolutionary trained, because there's so much stimulus and phenomena and events out there, it has just to select that which is really important to it. So if there's a snake outside, because it's important to your survival and safety, you'll focus on the snake, and everything else you won't be able to be aware of. The mind focuses on what's really important. And this is why you can train yourself, almost like make that marketing campaign, as I keep saying. The present moment is important. It's easy to convince yourself of that. You've spent too much time in the past and the future. It's never gotten you anywhere. You've had a few experiences of the present moment. You know that this is the Dharma. This is where peace, freedom, truth, joy, enlightenment lie. It doesn't lie anywhere else. You know that after a while, because you give this present moment the greatest value and importance, you focus. Once again, wisdom power, not willpower. I think there was a sutra somewhere, maybe Ajahn Brahmadi, even though he's on retreat, he may be able to find this for me, because I've been looking for it for a while, and just drop a piece of paper at breakfast for me where it is. It was, I think, Mahamoggallana went to see his great friend Sariputta, and Sariputta was busy just amending his robe. And I think little Mahamoggallana wanted to ask him to come to an appointment. And Sariputta was sewing his robe, which was, you know, he can't go to any of these meetings with an improper robe. So he said, when I finish my robe, I will go. And of course, those two great disciples of the Buddha, General Sariputta was empowered with great wisdom, and Mahamoggallana was empowered with the great psychic powers. And apparently, from the sutta I remember, Mahamoggallana decided, I'm going to test who's more powerful. Me with my psychic powers, you know, born of will, or Venerable Sariputta with his great wisdom, which is most powerful. And so he tried to stop Sariputta from sowing. And Sariputta just carried on sowing. Mahamoggallana could not interrupt his great friend. And I think it was at that point, the reason I remember the sutta, that Mahamoggallana remarked, yes, it's true, wisdom, power is more important and powerful than willpower. Wisdom always wins over will. Which is why I think that's a sutta there. I may have got it wrong, but never mind. I always make mistakes, and who cares anyway? So it's a great, and it should be true anyway, but if it's not. So it was the wisdom which is more powerful. That is why the reason why one focuses is not through willpower, but through wisdom power. But focus is important, because when you focus, it means everything which is out of that area of focus vanishes and disappears, which is so important. I don't know how much work you have to do, but you know, there's so much work which sometimes I have to do, If I don't focus, if I think of all the work I've got to do tomorrow, all the work I've just done, I'd go crazy. So you focus just on what you have to do right now. It's the only time you have anyway. So, you know, what is all this stuff about the future? Just one moment at a time and you get so much done. So one moment at a time is all one has. And in meditation it's so important, crucial. And you don't just focus loosely, you focus sharply on this present moment. I mentioned to some of you in your interviews that one of the tricks which, you know, I found out from my own practice, that sometimes you're meditating and you're getting very deep and there's a blockage, it's those blockage problems again. And one of the things, one of the methods I found very, very useful time and time again is just imagine my mind like, you know, looking in the viewer of a camera or of a telescope, or what I sometimes use, that theodolite, which is still at Jhana Grove, you know, to see the levels of the land. And you're looking through sort of an eyepiece, and sometimes what you see is not properly focused. It's a bit blurry. So you just move the lens. You twist it around a tiny bit, and then it becomes sharp, just like you focus a camera. And using that analogy, I look at my mind as if I'm looking through a lens, and it's not sharp. It's a bit fuzzy, which is the reason why I'm not getting power, not getting deeper. It's the reason why that some of you, you've got a light, you've got a limiter, but it's not sharp, it's not powerful. The piti sukha hasn't really bitten yet. What to do? Just imagine your mind like looking through that camera lens. Sharpen up the focus, especially in this present moment. And I do that, and it just gets so sharp that then all this bliss starts coming up. I realize my awareness was smeared in time. It wasn't properly focused. And it's not just, you know, the focusing in time. Just focus it on the silence. Just focus it on the breath. Just because, you know, you're aware of the breath, say. At any stage of the breath, you know, just the ordinary breath, the full awareness of the breath, the delightful breath, doesn't matter which. Have you ever noticed that sometimes, yeah, you're aware of the breath a little bit, but, you know, your plan of what you're going to have for tea afterwards, or, you know, you're aware of your body and the aches here, the sound of the kookaburras or the crows, whoever's, you know, next to your hut. Again, your awareness is smeared. It's not properly focused. Just like the TV. You can see all the things around the TV set. You can't really see what's just in the middle. And all those other things are still there, distracting you. You're not focused. So, again, what's more important? The sound of the crows, aches and pains in the body, which is, they're going to be there anyway. Mm. So you leave them all alone. They're not valuable to you. Instead, you just go to the breath. That's important, that's valuable. That's a path which is going to lead you to deep states of stillness, jhanas, enlightenment. This is what you're here for. So you give them importance above all other things. And if you give them importance above all other things, you'll find the mind just focuses in on the breath. You just can't hear the birds anymore. You can't feel the legs which are aching. You can't hear the sounds of, you know, people outside or the cars on the road. You just can't hear them anymore. They've fallen off your screen. Just like the ship, the model ship above one story's TV set vanished. You're just inside. And this going inside, focusing, is again what we do in meditation. So if you're ever distracted in the meditation, it means that, you know, those other things are important to you. You know, the plans, the memories, the dreams, the fantasies, they're more important to you. And look, what are you doing? Wasting so much time. So really get into this focusing. When you get into it, it's really beautiful fun. Because what you focus on remains, and everything else vanishes. And because there's not so many things, you are becoming still. And most of the movement of the mind is into the past or the future. Most of the movement is realized or is appears as the mind thinking. When you're staying with the breath, and all the thoughts vanish. Yeah, they're on the outside. They're like satellites, but after a while, the satellites just vanish. They fall off the edge of the screen. And all you've got left is just this breath. That's all there is. You're focused. Now you know how that focus works, and you know what it's like. It's ekodi, it's oneness, ekagata, the mind going to peaks of mind. And when actually this starts to happen, you get this trick of how to focus, putting your mind on the most important task at hand. In the same way that when you are shoveling the compost pile. That's the most important thing in the world. You're just focusing on that, and everything else disappears. This is a training we're doing. So this is why when you are forking the compost, you are developing the skills of meditation. When you're forking the compost, you're not thinking about other things. You're not in the past or the future. You're not watching the breath. You're just focusing on the forking of the compost. So you can see what we mean by whatever you're doing in this monastery, you can still learn these tricks of focusing, because that's the most important thing. One thing at a time. Just doing it, not thinking about it. It becomes easy. It's also developing these beautiful skills. So when you get into the breath becomes beautiful because that's all that's there. And it becomes still. And you feel this samadhi, this stillness and the ability just to watch. But watch with power, with depth. And of course, part of focusing means other things are vanishing. And that's the whole point of this meditation, to get so many things vanishing. You know, these layers and layers and layers which cover up the truth. Get them all disappeared, all this sensory objects, all this time business, all this thinking. I was just talking to someone this morning, just all this thinking, how long have you thought? Where's the thinking ever got you? How many people have become enlightened through thoughts? Have they become enlightened through silence? You know, after a while, you know, you should manage to understand at least that much, at least in theory. It's the thoughts which deceive you. I know that in Australia they had, I think it was a TV series, but I know, before I came, called The Dodgy Brothers. And they were second-hand car salesmen. And, you know, they were always sort of conning people out of their money, selling them cars which didn't work. This was, you know, owned by a Buddhist nun who never did anything, always cared for it. Actually, if they sold a car like that, I've seen the way they've used those vehicles in Dhammasala Dance Monastery. That's not a good car to buy. Yeah, you use them a lot, you travel a lot, you work hard. But no, you know, just, you know, only one owner, an old granny who kept it in the garage all her life. Then when it's really an old car which is being used. And so the Dodgy Brothers car dealers, that's my simile for my thinking. They always sell me lemons. They sell me all these great ideas, all the great things I can achieve and do. And it's just a con game. That's why it's important to focus away. But you know, it's hard to focus when these things tempt you. It's as if you're getting deep in meditation, you're getting deep and you're just focusing on this beautiful breath, but then you get tempted. Of course, you know who that tempter is, it's Mara. Mara's saying, well, you're getting still now, that's good enough. Because what happens when the mind becomes focused, it can focus on anything. And you know what it's like, sometimes you can focus on a fantasy or a dream or a train of thought. You can focus, you know, whatever you have to do and plan in your life. At that particular stage, the mind gets so powerful, you can actually focus so easily. You can divide, you could actually sit down on your desk and try and, you know, make out the plans for the hall at Dhammasala Monastery. But if you get into deep meditation, then you can actually see the design and you can play around with it and you can make this amazing hall. I mean, something which is really going to work, save a lot of money and do a great deal of things. You've been deceived by the Dodgy Brothers. Forget all of that. That's why, you know, that's Mara with his daughters. And for the nuns, or for anybody who's a monk building, and it's Mara and these building architects coming to deceive you, saying, Venerable Niroda, you can build a much better sala than you've got planned. Just change it here and change it there. I know you, Mara, get out of here. Or Mara can come with the perfect translation of the Anguttara Nikaya. Ajahn, this is a much better translation of that word Kayapati Sangwedi than you got before. I know you, Mara, get out of here. Whatever else it is. Anagarika, I got this perfect recipe for lasagna. It's amazing what you can think of when you get into deep samadhi. So be very careful there. But of course, I was saying to, I gave a Skype talk to Ayatata Loka and the nuns, Bhikkhunis, over in San Francisco, just last Monday, I think it was. And I mentioned to them that be careful in your meditation, because it's not just those sorts of traps. The Dodgy Brothers can sell you what I've called a Bodhisattva trap. You can do so much for humankind. You can become a great teacher. You can write the book, you know, much better than Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond. You know, the real meditation, the real enlightenment. And you know, when you get into that, it's very convincing, because at that particular stage, the Dharma is just so clear and so beautiful. And you can do so much for the world. Just like Mara came and offered the Buddha the opportunity to be a world-turning monarch, the best president and prime minister, will bring peace to the whole world, would abolish famine and exploitation, and everybody will be free and happy and joyful. And of course, sometimes people get caught up in that. And that is the Dodgy Brothers again. Because your job is to focus, to be still, to get samadhi. That's why that was called, you know, by the Buddha in the Anguttara, I think it's in the 3s or the 9s, whatever, he said the lingering obstacle to stillness, the worst of all, is Dhamma Vitaka, where your mind gets so focused, maybe close to nimitta stage, and you can work it all out. You can give your incredible sermon, the best teaching which has ever been released onto the world. And you can do that at that stage of meditation. Your mind is clear, just no thoughts become linear, they don't go off on tangents anymore. You can take an idea and you can progress it, and it's brilliant stuff. That's Mara. Shut up. Don't buy into that. Focus and go deeper into the stillness. So those are the problems there. You've got to be very careful, because at each of those stages you're tempted away from focusing. And of course, after a while you realise how much time you've wasted, you know, just following those little temptations, which take away the value from the stillness and give it to, you know, helping the whole world or writing the book or whatever else it is, you know, which is saying that this is more important than being enlightened. This is going to help everybody. Yeah, it's a nice thing to do. It's compassionate. It's noble, but it's stupid at the same time. Never underestimate the power of Mara to try and stop you becoming enlightened, to try and stop you becoming still, to try and stop you getting jhanas and a taste of freedom. Remember, the jhanas are the place where Mara is blindfolded. Mara can't see you there. That's why that Mara just gets really pissed off when someone gets close to that stage. Try everything to stop you getting out of his reach. Why is Mara can't get there? Because their all will stops. Mara, the controller, can't get to places where there's no will. It's got no way to get a handle on you. So that's why we focus until all this stuff disappears. All the temptations vanish. Just like things falling off the edge of the screen. You can't even see the edges of the TV. You just got into the center. and going to the centre of the centre, and the centre of the centre of the centre. That's just what happens with focusing. And of course, you just focus right into the centre of the breath until actually the things which you recognise the breath by the edges of the breath, just like the edges of the screen is what you, a lot of times you recognise a TV by. Its edges, its circumference, what bounds it. When you go inside without those boundaries, things disappear and it's a different world. Which is why that every stage of this meditation, things vanish and it's like a different experience, a different reality. Even just the delightful breath is a different reality than many of you have experienced before. Delightful, but in a strange way, in a beautiful way. And of course, just focus in, always focusing, letting go of the peripheral stuff, which is the breath. All this going in and going out stuff, long breath, short breath, in between breaths, that is like the screen on it, that's the edges of the screen, that's not essential to what breath truly is. So those just fall off the screen. So you've just got delightful breath. Before your whole breath disappears, now hopefully that you can recognize, not at the time but afterwards, there was no in perception, there's no out perception, no long or short or even in between the in breath and out breath sensations. You focus so much inside the breath that those edges of the breath have vanished, just like the edges of a screen vanish. You know, when the edges of a screen vanish, you don't know whether that's a huge plasma screen TV or a tiny TV set. They all look the same when the edges have vanished. Long breath, short breath, in and out, that particular aspect of the breath, that perception is gone. And you know, the more simple it is, the more still it is, the more powerful it is. And we all have the idea of simplicity in monasticism, having few things, you know, just eating just once a day, just in a bowl, simple robes, few possessions. That simplicity is not just a rule imposed upon you to make life difficult. It is this whole ethos which you do in meditation. Just have such few possessions in your mind as you're meditating and willing to let everything go and just have one thing left and one thing, just half a thing and a quarter of a thing, but a fraction of a thing. Allowing things to vanish, to get more and more beautiful simplicity. Of course, then you get into the delightful breath, the delight stays, nimittas come. Where do the nimittas come from? Just focus some more. Just this moment is all you have. Just wanting something more. If you smear the attention into the future, that's called expectations. If you smear the attention into the past, that's longing for what you had before. You keep the focus in this moment. There's a great skill which stops all desire of ill will, stops the hindrances from really being able to grab onto you. In silence, you can't give any orders anymore. Shut up. You're just totally still, you focus in, allow the wisdom power that this is really important. And by this time, you know, you don't really need to convince yourself that much. It's obvious, it's apparent. That delightful breath is profound, it's beautiful, it smells of insight and liberation. You're getting close to the taste of freedom. You can taste it, you can smell it. And as you go, now that's only sort of a metaphor. And as you get closer and closer, you just focus in and in and in. Going into the center and all these external things, the edges of the screen, they vanish. You just go into, that's where you get this beautiful nimitta from. It just appears in the very center of your perception and pushes all these external things away. And we've just got this great, beautiful, big ball of energy, light, bliss. Focus. Don't focus on the outside, focus on the inside. And of course, what you focus on, even the edges of the nimitta disappear. It's like the TV screen. Just go right into it. that degree of focus. Why do you do that? Because that's the most important part. And don't be afraid of the power. Don't be afraid of the energy. It's beautiful. You know it's good. You know that this is the path. You just dive into it. That's called the focusing. And of course, as a result of that focusing, what you're focusing on remains. And all these other external things vanish. The ship on top of the TV is long since gone. The body surrounding your mind. The five senses, which just distract you and are endless with their demands, is gone. It's a sense of freedom. That's why Ananda used to say, this is like the escape hole. You're going deep in, where you can escape from the five senses, and escape from thinking, escape from time, escape from all this stuff, which is the stuff of samsara and suffering. You're deep into the jhanas, blissing out. Well done, enjoy. But it's not just for the sake of enjoyment. It's all you learn on the way. Now, the enjoyment is like the free gift, you know, which we get, you know, with every jhana. But the main purpose is the great insights you get on the path. The bliss is this little extra. You shouldn't really call it extra because it's immense. Now you know what focusing is. Things have disappeared. Just like that student, all he could see is the eyeball of a bird. Now all you can see is this beautiful mind. The bird? What bird? What body? Tree? What tree? All I can see is Nimitta. All I can see is jhana. Nothing else is there. Ah, now you can shoot the arrow of wisdom. And of course, it pierces. You see, you understand what this whole purpose of this meditation is. Why the Buddha taught. See, just when things disappear, all you're letting go is your suffering. You're freeing yourself from all these attachments. You're going deeper and deeper, focusing. And that's what happens, as I've mentioned in, again, many other talks. That whole tendency to focus just continues. You just carry on focus automatically. You just go into the first jhana. In the center of that first jhana, you see the second. In the center of the second, you see the third. Just go in, all the way. And all the way as you go in, more and more things vanish. More and more edges disappear. More and more the things which define things. You know this monastery, what's it defined by? It's defined by the fence and by the wall. That's actually how we define things, by its edges, by its boundaries. You define your body by the skin which surrounds it. See the edges which define things, and when you go deep inside and those edges disappear, it's a different reality. And you realize that all of those boundaries, that definitions, in science we used to call it the boundary conditions, which define the reality inside. It's part of the equation. Yeah, you notice the laws of physics, but the boundary conditions together with the laws define that reality. That's physics. If any of you understand what I'm talking about. But it's the edges which define. And when they vanish, you go deep inside. That's all gone. The different reality. Freedom from all of those attachments. Freedom from things. Things vanishing, disappearing. And all those things which were so important to you. Bodies, five senses, will, doing things. And see them for what they truly are, only when they vanish. And the old simile of the tadpole, which I won't repeat now. So this is what one does when one focuses. That's what samadhi is. It creates the stillness, the shh. I don't know, maybe the Chinese word shu comes from the English word shh. Very unlikely, but nevertheless, it's worth saying. Silence, shut up, shh, samadhi. That's actually also the Sanskrit word for samatha, shabbata. I think I'm going to stop. So this is focusing. So try it in your meditation. And remember how I started this talk, just focusing on just forking the compost, just washing the dishes, just doing one thing. Wisdom power says this is important, all the rest doesn't really matter. Past and future doesn't matter, now is the only thing which is worthwhile. Don't use your willpower, you just get stuffed up. Use the wisdom power. That leads to focusing. And the focusing leads to other things disappearing. And then you'll be like that third student of the teacher. What body? What time? What defilements? All I can see is the eye of wisdom, the Dhamma Chakku. That's the talk for this evening.
And the man who wanted to tie a sabi put on the Dhamma scene.
Sadhu, 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 anubhava. Sankara, Sankara, Sankara.